All right, now please help me welcome our headliner tonight, Matthew M. from Ojai.
Thanks, Cody. Thank you, Heather. That was great. My name is Matthew. I have alcoholism. My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993. And it's such a pleasure to be with the people of Santa Maria and Lompoc. Lompoc or Lompoc? Lompoc. See, that's how you know I'm not local. No, everybody's so kind here. And what's been moving me lately, and did tonight, just looking around and being in line for the potluck and just seeing everybody is, you know, I have alcoholism in my family. My grandfather died of it. In fact, Bill Wilson 12-stepped my grandfather, and he died of alcoholism. My brothers both have it. And I know what kind of, like, real heartache it brings. And I know the darkness. And I look around and think of all these people and their happy families and your good relationships and your honesty in your life and my life. You know, I've raised 4 children in AA, and we have a happy, loving home. And I mean, I never get over how profound that is, you know. And I think all of us who've worked with newcomers for a long time know that doesn't happen for everybody. And I love what Heather said. Well, I love what Heather's like, I got sent to rehab when I was in 8th grade, but alcohol was working for me. It's because she was blacking out. I love that. I love that. But I was thinking, what a lovely 8 years you've had, you know, and what a crappy time you had before. Like, I know, because, you know, I'm like that. My sobriety date's May 16th, 1993, and I don't want to waste a lot of time getting into too much of what it was like, but how many people are in their first year? Okay, good. And Javi, welcome, man. Calling you out on purpose. Cody with 2 years, dressed like guy with 2 years, right on. And Ryan is going to be here next week with his back against the wall. And congratulations to the Franks. And like that, makes it easy. But I'll just say that, you know, I didn't really drink in high school. My brother was ruining my life and my family life, and I drank once, and it was a terrible thing. But I went off to college, and I forgot about not drinking. And when I was 30 years old, I had drank myself out of my favorite job. I was a lead guitar player from a touring recording band. I'd gotten 2 degrees in college from my mother and my father because I loved and respected them, and my brothers both failed at that, and they really wanted to help us. I always feel guilty, you know, when I go to AA, because I know I sponsor a lot of people, and I know that a lot of us were raised by wolves. I know that. I know that. I was raised by golden retrievers. Super nice, friendly, loved me, had my back the whole time. It's almost embarrassing. I'm really sorry. I had a really nice functional family. But we had alcoholism, you know. It doesn't matter what you think of it. We had it. And what my life looked like in May of 1993, I'll just pick a day in May, like before the 16th. I remember vaguely, I had this apartment to myself because my roommate, who actually was on the lease, it had been transferred to Mexico City and he wanted to keep the apartment. So I was supposed to be sending him rent, but he lived... moved to Mexico, and I'm like, God, that Mexican mail is just terrible, because my rent never showed up. But so I was in this apartment by myself by the beach. In fact, the ocean was not farther, too much farther than that back wall. But I never saw it. I heard it. You know, I knew it was out there. At night, I wondered what it was. You know, when you're kind of addled, and you're like, what's that noise? I actually, one time, I oiled my screen door. Because I thought the ocean was my screen door, but it was God out there, you know. But in May of 1993, what it kind of looked like for me, and this is for everybody in their first year, just to qualify and get you to trust that I have alcoholism, is I woke up almost every day in that last 5 months of my drinking and thought, don't drink today. I didn't think it. I said it out loud, and I was by myself. Say, don't drink today. And I'd all my... noble reasons were gone. You know, I already lost the job that I loved. I lost some jobs that were beneath me. Remember that? When you get the lame job because you're such a bad drunk, and then you lose it because you can't even do the lame job. I lost a couple of those. And I would wake up and say, don't drink today. My mother was dying of cancer. That didn't stop me from drinking. I'd gotten a girl pregnant at my last job that was beneath me. That didn't stop me from drinking. She was across town getting more and more pregnant. Yeah, I had warrants out for my arrest. I wanted to stop drinking at each of these junctures or at least calm down. I knew when I was going to get kicked out of the band. I could see the writing on the wall. It's not like they kicked me out the first time I didn't show up. They gave me lots. I mean, I was a contributor. I was a writer. And they said, dude, we can't handle you anymore. So I knew it was coming, and I tried to not do it. But in May of 1993, I was just alcoholic. You know, I mean, I don't know how to say. I wake up, say, don't drink today. And it wasn't because I thought I was going to get my life together. It was because I was sick all the time. And I was young. You know, I was real skinny. I had the runs all the time. And I wake up in my dirty sheets and say out loud, like, don't drink today. And I think part of alcoholism is I would agree with me. First of all, there's two of me. I'm like, yeah, don't drink today, you know. Like Gollum, like my precious, you know, don't drink. I don't know why I'm talking to myself out loud, but I'm agreeing with me that that's a great idea. And I also am believing me. I'm not, thank God, I'm not going to drink today. And I've just said it out loud. I said it yesterday. I said it the day before. But for some reason, each day I'd go, man, thank God, that's the first thing we're taking care of. And I'm just piecing together what these days look like. I'd walk down the hall, and there was a nice, beautiful bathroom. It was a nice apartment. Not when I ended, not when I left, but when I moved in. But I walked into this bathroom, and I'd get in the shower, maybe, let's say, that day I did. And, you know, I'm feeling like the worst person on earth. I feel like a lizard physically. You know, like I'm not quite human. And I'd get in the shower, and that hot water would hit my head. And I don't know if you can relate to this, but I would get 8% better, just above the ground. And I'd be, oh, this isn't so bad. And maybe I'd wash my hair. I didn't always do that, but let's say I did that day. And now I'm feeling like, hey, I'm not drinking and I'm clean. I'm like really doing great. It's a big day for me. And I hadn't worked in months. And then I would think a thought. Usually at that time, my thought would be, go see mom. Because my mother was really sick with cancer. And I adored my mother. My mother's why I'm a musician. She actually came to yard duty. I went to a small Catholic school with Lee's first wife. And we were at my, if you went to that school, your parents had to volunteer. And, you know, I didn't have any money. So you had to go down there and be yard duty. And my mom saw me in seventh grade, I guess, and she came home from school, and I was sitting in the front room listening to music, and she said, hey, you don't get picked first for the team, do you? And I go, I don't care about that, Mom. And she goes, yeah, but I watched you, like, Casey, all my friends, yeah, they're all athletes. And I go, Mom, I'm competitive, but not like that. And she said, do you want to play an instrument? And I about flew out of the chair and said, I want to play the guitar. Because, you know, this, I was listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. My brothers were older, so I was listening to music a little bit before my time. And all I could hear was guitar. Eric Clapton was like a hero of mine. And she's like, okay, we'll get you a guitar. Like, I was so overly excited. And we had a guitar in like 3 hours. It wasn't a great guitar, but I thought it was the sexiest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And we ate soup for like 2 weeks. And I'm such a bad Catholic, I thought it was Lent. Like, I'm like, oh, I guess it's Lent. We're having soup. She had spent all our budget on my guitar because she loved me. So I'm in the shower now. Blue became a very good musician. Still am. I play every day. But I got Blue my career, and I've got this girl pregnant, and I'm unemployed, and I'm drunk all the time. And I think, I'll go see Mom. I'm feeling good. I'm going to go see Mom. And then there's this thing, you know, it's in this book. There's a beautiful prayer in the third step. I love that you brought up the third step, Heather. It says, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self. And when I remember when I heard that, I was like, I thought it was weird. I had to kneel on my kitchen floor with my sponsor. I thought, this is really weird, you know. But when he said, relieve me of the bondage of self, and I repeated that after him, I thought, God, please. Because after I stopped drinking, this was treacherous. You know, I don't know about you guys, but for me, the bondage of self, like I walk into a room and I have to paint everybody in the room with my interior ugliness. So I can, like, you're a cheat, I'm a cheat, you lie, I lie, you stole from work, I stole. I just have to do that so I feel comfortable. And that's a terrible way to live. So, but also I noticed being in AA a long time is that one of the symptoms of the bondage of self is fear. So the number one. The number two is blame, right? I've noticed this over the years, my own and people I sponsor. I've watched it. You can tell. You want to hold them down. You're in the bondage of self. But when you're in the bondage of self, you don't know it. And I get out of the shower. I'm going to go see my mom. I'm clean. I'm not drinking. I'm batting 1,000. And my foot would hit that bath mat. And I think, well, wait, what do mom and dad know? And what do they not know? And now I'm afraid. Do they know that this girl's 18 and I'm 30 years old? Pausing for you to judge me. It's fine. I don't care. I work the steps and judge away. Do they know I don't play music at all? Do they know I don't work at the restaurant anymore? I don't know what they know. So I walk to the shower, the sink. Let's say, again, I'm just trying to, for the people who are new. And I'd start shaving. And in the mirror, I'd think, well, I could go next door to Mr. BJ's liquor store and get 2 beers. And honestly, I'm not joking. 2 beers is not drinking. I drink gin. I want fast, fast, fast. And I get 2 beers, which is like nothing. It's like this stuff to me, you know. So that's cool because I'm still going to go see mom and dad. I'm still not drinking. I'm still clean. I just want to calm down enough so when I'm in their presence, I can shuck and jive, kind of feel them out, ask some probing questions, find out what they know and don't know, and I could posture my way into being a good son. Because one of the things touring with a band teaches you, because you see the same people every year, is how to schmooze with people you can't remember. So I've done this a lot. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to get 2 beers, and I'm going to see my mom. And if you'd held a gun to my head and said, when was the last time you saw your mom? I would have said, like 3 weeks ago. It had been 7 months, but I thought I went there all the time. So I went next door, maybe, let's say. But I remember this, going to get 2 beers, and then you get to the beer cooler and how small they look. Like, when did beers get so small? You know, seriously, like in my head, I'm like, that's crazy. But thank God for Australia, right? Because right above are Foster's. They're like, there's oil can beers. But I'm not drinking. But my thought is, well, that's 2 beers. Yeah. I'll just drink one, and I'll have one when I get home because I don't want to spend all my money. So, but Mr. BJ was so great. I would go up and put my beers on the counter, and he would look over his glasses. He would go, Matthew, you have a problem, and your problem tells you that you don't have a problem. And I would say, every time he said that, I would go, are you the Riddler? Because I just want to buy this, you know. We did this yesterday, right? And he'd shake his head, but over his shoulder is a bottle of gin, and Foster's are pricey. And I can buy that gin for this same price, but I'm not drinking. So I know I'm not going to go home and drink that whole bottle of gin, but I, you know what, I don't want these. I'll take that. And I'm going to go home and just have a little smack off that gin. Anybody see Easy Rider? Jack Nicholson, remember when he's sitting around the fire, he goes, nick, nick, after he hits the drink? I love that scene because I go, yeah, man, I totally get that. That great familiar feeling of now I'm here. So I'd sit down on the couch and I'd take that hit and I'd feel better. And I'm going to go see my mom. I know I am. I know I am. But I just want another drink. And in about half an hour, I'm drinking it kind of fast. Because I want to forget that I was going to go see my mom. And I did that over and over and over. And what I meant by I was only an alcoholic is my guitars were disappearing off the walls and into pawn shops. I had all these surfboards outside. They never went. The ocean was right there. So I guess it said on the flyer I'm a surfer. I think that's given me a lot of credit. But I used to do that quite a bit. Well, I used to not do it when I was drinking, but I had these great surfboards leaning against. Well, I had thousands of books. I still do. You can't read when you're drunk. And I'm such a snob and an elitist. I had this really good TV, but I never turned it on because TVs were losers. So I would sit there and drink and look at my reflection in a TV that didn't work all day. You know, one of the things it says in this book that I always laugh at, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Like we're James Bond, you know? I think alcoholism is so, we never talk about this. It's so boring. It's so mundane. It's like mind-numbingly boring. I have a lot of interests, and I'm sitting in the same place every day with everything at my fingertips, not answering the door because, you know, who knows who they are. And remember when the mail got all weird, like it turned red, you know, final notice, like I'm not bringing that stuff in my house, like that kind of energy, I'm not bringing that in there. I got a nice house, you know. So if you're new here, that's why I'm qualified to come here, because I didn't want to drink. I really didn't want to drink for years. And in the last year, I didn't want to drink because I knew, really knew, I was killing myself. I was having weird spasms. I couldn't sleep right. I had the runs all the time. I had dry heaves. It wasn't fun, but I couldn't stop. So that's what I was like. And what happened was this brother, one of my brothers, he was 12 years sober, and he called me on my sobriety date's May 16th, and Mother's Day was May 9th in 1993, and he called me May 8th. And he said, hey, tomorrow's Mother's Day, and I think it's Mom's last Mother's Day, and we just want to really show up, and it's at the King Harbor Yacht Club, and I'll come pick you up. And he was so nice. He goes, I know you're having car trouble. My family doesn't like to hurt each other's feelings. We're Irish Catholics. My sister said, if there's a elephant in the living room, we just make a coffee table out of it. Like, nobody talks about anything. But my car trouble was I had a key that had an insignia of a car. I just hadn't seen the other part for a really long. I knew I had it. I knew it existed in the world, but it didn't exist in my life, you know. And he said, I'll come get you. And all I could hear was, it's Mom's last Mother's Day. I couldn't believe it. Because like I said, like, I've been all around the world. I have thousands of friends. I'm married to probably the best person I've ever met, and the finest human being I know is my mother. And I want to really blow her mind. I'm going to show up like her youngest boy, and I'm going to get flowers, and I'm going to make a card. I have a degree in modern literature and a degree in comparative religion. So what I'm qualified to do is write a Mother's Day card. That's it. Like, no one's ever interviewed me and go, what do you know about Faulkner and Islam? I mean, like, I'm not marketable. But I could really write a good card. And I really love my mom. And I really knew what I wanted to say in that card. And you know what, though? I just went next door and saw the Riddler, you know? And I didn't get the card. I didn't do my laundry. I didn't even go to sleep. And my brother honks his horn. It felt like he just hung up the phone. And I smell, and I'm looking around, and I'm shocked that I'm not prepared. But I looked around my apartment. I didn't want him to come in, so I just kind of slung my greasy hair over, and I ran outside. And I'll never forget this. I was running to his car, and he looked up, and his mouth dropped. And I thought my clothes were dirty. I didn't know it, but I weighed 108 pounds. And I'm a little shorter than I was then, and I weigh 155 now. I don't know how I was alive, but he could see my skeleton. And I jumped in his car, and he just kind of looked at me because no one had seen me. And I was the guy who got 2 degrees. I was the guy who toured the world. I was the guy who did everything he ever said he was going to do. And then they took me down to the yacht club, and I'll just wrap this up. I ruined Mother's Day. And I don't know why. I don't know what I did. I don't know why I did that. My sister, I actually didn't have the nerve to ask anybody until my 20th AA birthday 13 years ago. And I called my sister, who now is my best friend. And I said, what happened on Mother's Day? And she said, oh, no, we won't discuss that. I'm like, it was 20 years ago. And she said, you were vile to our mother. And I loved her, and I respected her, and I couldn't control myself. And it's still hard to talk about that. And I did much worse stuff than ruin Mother's Day. But that really hurts me, because she was dying. And my brother saw that, and he said, let's get out of here. And okay, and because we left early. And on the way home, we got in a big fight. You know, probably about that. Neither of us can remember what we were fighting about. But anybody else Irish Catholic? Like, it's pretty common. Yeah, right. You're like swans on a lake. Everything's fine. Like, blah, blah, blah. Okay, see you at Thanksgiving. Say hi to Mom. Like, we do it all the time. And we get out of the car, and I remember, and, you know, I was going to talk about something tonight. I hope I get to talk about grace. Because I know, Javi, and if you're in your first year, and whatever your experience, like, fortunately, Heather joined a church before, but the God thing puts people off, right? Because we have all these bag. I went to Catholic school. I was raised by the witches of God. I had nuns teaching me. Yeah. So I have... Hey, Sister B says it's okay if I call them that. And that's what we called them, you know. They were scary. I have a lot of baggage with God, but I have no baggage at all with grace. And I didn't know when I slammed that door in my brother's car that I was setting the wheels of grace in motion, because what I decided right then was, I'm not losing this fight. And that's alcoholism too. I just ruined Mother's Day for a dying woman. And I had the moral higher ground in whatever argument we were at. I'm like, no way. And part of it was I'd grown up his little brother my whole life, you know. And he was a bad drunk when I was in grade school. He's 7 years older than me. And I'm like, I'm not losing. And I went into my room, my apartment. I was pacing around the apartment waiting for him to drive back to Lawndale. And that takes a while from Redondo. And I'm just thinking all the stuff I'm going to say to him. And I don't know that God's going, please make that phone call. I don't know God's waiting for this to happen. And I only know this looking back. But I called him up. He answered the phone. And he said hello. And I just blasted him. And I'd love to know. I'd love a transcript of this. Like, I just ruined Mother's Day, but I'm telling him off, right? My 12-year sober brother at the time, who showed up, who didn't lie, was married and faithful, went to work every day. He was like... He lived in his car, and now he's like this miracle man. He ruined my high school years and my grade school years, lots of them, for just a chaos in our house. And he's 12 years sober, and I'm screaming at him. And I ran out of steam, and he go, I don't know what I said, but I just got tired, I guess. And he just said into the phone very calmly, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And then the grace came. Now, I'd heard that before. I'd heard that from band managers. I was engaged for like 20 minutes once. But then I met her parents, and they're like, walk with me, talk with me. You know, you're not going to marry our daughter. You're a drunk. And I'm like, I'm not a drunk. My brother's a drunk. He lives in his car. I'm touring. You know, I have records. And so my brother said, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And just almost involuntary out of my mouth, kind of like you're drunk driving, I just said, of course I do. And I don't know if it was just every day waking up and not being able to not drink. I don't know why I said that. I didn't think I would say that. And I just blurted it out. And then my brother said something really funny. He goes, don't go anywhere. And I go, okay. You know, I was going to move to that end of the couch in the fall, but, you know, I don't really go anywhere, you know. And he just flew to my house, and I'm so grateful he did. I mean, he lived far away, and he got there way faster than was legal for him to do. And I know now why. He heard the most precious thing in this whole place, and it's called willingness. It's in this book like 136 times. Some form of the word willing is in this book. You know what shows up more in the 12 and 12? Grace. Because Bill had 10 years answering letters about this book. So he heard willingness in my involuntary spasm of course I do, and he raced to my house. It's so funny, I remember this, because I thought he was going to come through the door and kind of punch me, and then I wouldn't drink anymore. I mean, I just ruined Mother's Day, you know, and I just yelled at him. And I kind of had some history with him, thinking that might be his tactic. But he walked in the apartment, he inhaled and goes, let's go to the beach. It was a little ripe in there, you know. I had the SWAT-proof blankets on the windows. Remember to keep the SWAT teams out at 2 o'clock in the morning? Put this mover blanket. They can't get in here, right? And no windows have been open since the Reagan administration. And he's like, let's go to the beach. And we went down to the beach, and I always try to share this really accurately. I was very afraid of him. and I didn't know what he was going to say. And I just worked the first half of the first step. I'd admitted I was powerless, and I didn't know I'd done that. And then we sat on this lifeguard stand, and I'm trying to light a cigarette, and I'm shaking because I hadn't had a drink. And he goes, here, give those to me. And he lit two cigarettes, and my brother didn't smoke. And he handed me one, and he took one. He was just like, don't worry, just chill out. So that was interesting. And then he looked right over my head for a minute. And then he started telling me how he felt when my mom and dad kicked him out of our house. And I remember that. I was 11 years old. And he was 18. He'd gotten his high school girlfriend pregnant. And he just ruined, I mean, really, I don't want to go back there, but just really real darkness for years. And they threw him out at the advice of a therapist. They threw him out. And I remember thinking, we don't do that to ours. And I was a little boy. And I remember it really clearly. And my brother's sitting there telling me how he felt that day. That got my interest. And it wasn't what I expected. And then he kind of looked at me and said, what's your plan? And I thought, he doesn't know, man. I got like warrants, you know. I owe everybody money. And I'm starting to think about, he doesn't even realize. And then he started telling me how he felt when his wife and son kicked him out of their house. And I remember that. I was like 14, 15 years old. I remember because he called me, my cool brother. My brother was very good looking, played the drums, and he looked like Paul McCartney. And he was a really smart businessman, way better than I ever was. And he called me because he had no one left. And I remember on the phone, I was 14, I go, why don't you stop drinking? Because I could see clearly. And he said, you don't understand. And I didn't, because I hadn't started drinking. And we have this gene, you know, it's all through my family. And then he goes, what's your plan? And I thought, God, he doesn't know that I pushed that pregnant girl down a flight of stairs two nights ago. He doesn't know who I've become. And then I didn't know it, but I was working the second half of the first step. I was seeing my life and realizing my own brother wouldn't even believe me how unmanageable this is. And I want to be clear, I'm not violent with women. I respected this woman. She just wanted me to go to the doctor, and I was really loaded, like really loaded. And she goes, you know, maybe don't drink today. And I thought she was saying, you're a bum. And I remember her wrists were so thin, I can remember this really clearly, and I grabbed her wrist and I pushed her so she'd go out the door so I could slam the door, because I could barely talk. And I saw her go, and I slammed the door because I didn't want responsibility. That's what I was like. And I'm looking at him thinking, I don't have a plan. And then he told me how he felt when he lived in his car. And right then, I thought, he's talking about how I feel. That's what he's doing right now. Because he described it perfectly. And that's what it says to do in this book. It says, tell them a little bit about your own story and win their confidence. It's an art, 12 steps. It's an art, the 12th step. And thank God my brother didn't see his punky little brother who just ruined Mother's Day. My brother came armed with certain facts about himself, looking at a man dying of alcoholism, who he loved. And he just walked me through how he felt, and I realized he knows how I feel. And I threw up my hands and I said, you know, man, I'll go to AA. And this wise Buddha like disappeared. He went, AA? You're not going to AA. And I go, I'm not. And he goes, no, man, you're going to a hospital. And I remember going, I actually said, I can't do that. I'm really busy. Like, anybody remember that? Like, too busy for rehab? Like, I almost killed my child two nights ago. I had a gun in my mouth yesterday. But let's not rush into rehab, you know. What is wrong with us? I don't get it. But then I said, how long? He goes, 30 days. I'm like, oh, my God, you know. That's crazy talk. And I was really thinking, like, I can't leave all this. You know, who's not going to pay my bills, man? What am I thinking? You know, what are we thinking? But I was afraid. I didn't even know I was afraid. And my brother We walked back to my apartment. I walked up the stairs and he looked up and he goes, "Hey." I looked down and he goes, "This might take a little while. Don't die." And I got so embarrassed. I thought he knew about the gun, and we don't kill ourselves, not my family. But I was so dramatic. I used to take the screen off the window and open the window at 2 a.m, put one bullet in the gun and stick it in my mouth, you know. And then I didn't have any courage, and it was really just self-pity and drama. I remember I used to carry that bullet. It was a hollow point bullet. It was my roommate's gun. I'd carry that bullet for like my first year of sobriety because, you know, I was a dramatic newcomer and this is how bad it got. I kept it in a little silk purse from Chinatown. And I remember one day I pulled it out after I'd been working the steps, and that little bullet said, "This is what a self-centered little puke you became." And I threw that bullet away. I don't want a back-talking bullet in my pocket. But it was so stupid. I wasn't going to kill myself. Not then. So on May 15th, he called, and I'd kind of forgotten about, you know, we're going to rehab. It was a week ago. And he goes, "Hey, I got it all set up. I'm going to come pick you up tomorrow." And he goes, "I hate to tell you this, but we're going to go see Mom and Dad." I'm like, "Ah, I don't want to see Mom and Dad." And he goes, "I'm so sorry. We got to sign some papers. They're probably going to drive you the rest of the way." And so I would love to tell you I decided to do my laundry and clean my apartment, but I went, "Rehab, let's go see the Riddler," you know, and I went and spent all my money and I got as hammered as I could possibly get because I was afraid and I didn't know I was afraid. That's why my hat's off to these guys who are new and in your first year and the 2 year guys. My first year, I was afraid all the time and I didn't even know it. These steps take a while. I got in with people that we got into it right away, but it took a while. But he said, so I got drunk. I passed out on the floor. I fell backwards. I remember it's such a weird, like you remember these weird details. I fell backwards. I know that because when the phone rang in the morning, I had my neck in this weird position against the wall and my back was really wet and I didn't know why. And I'd fallen on a big gulp that apparently Martians brought over because I lived like 5 miles from 7-Eleven and I never left my house. But I really don't. You remember when Martians left stuff at your house? And then Martians stole stuff in the night? Yeah. Well, the Martians came because I woke up and I'm like, God, I'm so uncomfortable. And I only answered the phone because I thought it was my brother. I go, "Hello." And this woman said, "Where have you been?" And I didn't know who it was. I go, "Who are you?" And she goes, "Your daughter was born. We've been calling you all night." But I don't answer the phone at 3 a.m. because that's the bad guys. Those are the guys I'm afraid of way more than the police. And she goes, can you come to the hospital? And I said, yes. Like I just opened my eyes. I'm all sticky on my back. I have like OR scrubs on and a t-shirt. I look like Marlon Brando, but I actually look like a boat person. I think I look like Marlon Brando, right? And I get up and I find some flip-flops and I get my car key and all me and my optimism and my hangover went out into the night, the day, May 16th, my sobriety date. And I'm walking around looking for my car, right? And I found it, Grace. That car had been missing for a long time. And in Redondo Beach, they tow those away or boot them. And it had like 10 tickets on it. And it was still sitting there. And it was an AMC and it started. Grace, right? It sounded terrible. It was like... And I loved it. I love this book. It says we're selfish and self-centered. I drove directly to the wrong hospital. I like hauled over there. I went to the hospital where I was born. Because that's where babies are born, you know. And I'm not kidding. This is my underwear. Annie used to tell me, I got to tell you where the baby, I'm like, I know where babies come from, you know. And I go in there and you know, I run in there and I'm all sticky and dirty and smelly and I'm not really prepared. And the lady's like, you can yell at me all you want. They're not here. And when I left there, like sometimes you hear people in AA talk about moments of clarity. And they act like they're good things. They're not. They're like cold water, like in your face, you know. And I walked out of there and I had a moment of clarity. The way I thought to kind of demonstrate this is I go to the Getty Museum whenever I can. And I love the Antiquities Museum in Malibu. And there's a vase in that museum. It's like this tall and it's really crinkled glass. It's very thin. And it's been around since 500 years before Christ. And I always just stare at that, like mesmerized by its fragility and its life. And it was like that vase was in my hands in that parking lot, and it's my character and my dignity and my self-respect. It's all the love my parents gave me. It's all the teachers I had that taught me, you can do this, go for it. It's all the love I've had. It's all the interventions I've had that made me have these wonderful gifts. It's my talent. It's the love in my life. And it was like I took this thing and smashed it in the parking lot, and it was just these little tiny pieces glittering up at me. Because the moment of clarity was, I can't fix that. It's never coming back. Particularly because I knew my brother didn't drink anymore, but I thought my character and my dignity and my self-respect are unsalvageable. And I knew then I could shoot myself. And I walked in my car and I was crying, but sort of crying like whimpering, you know, just like it's done, I'm done. I don't want to go to rehab. I don't want to meet this baby. I'm selfish and I don't even know it. And I get in the car and I decide to go shoot myself with the gun, and I know I can do it. And I put my head on the steering wheel and I started that AMC, and the whole car went like it just jerked, and my head bounced off the steering wheel, and the name of the right hospital came into my head. And I think that's grace. If you, anybody here do the 11 step meditate? Anybody try to meditate? Well, I meditate every day for 25 years. I've meditated every day, 20 minutes a day. And if you try for the first 5 days, the first thing you find out is, wow, I'm not in charge of the thoughts that come into my head. You know, Jackie would know this girl. I remember I was in Australia speaking at a conference, and I was meditating, and Carla Rojo came into my head. Carla Rojo wouldn't go to a dance with me in eighth grade. I'm 63. And I was like, yeah, Carla Rojo, you know, all over again. It's like 2 years ago. That's how random our thoughts are, right? And I wasn't trying to think of the name of the right hospital. I had an involuntary electrical impulse go across my gray matter and go, St. John's. And I didn't shoot myself. I think we're swimming in grace. I think I can't see it because I'm in the bondage of self. So I drove right to the right hospital. I ran up the stairs. I ran into that room. And there's Anna. And Anna, have you ever seen a woman that just had a baby? Not her best look. She looked like a truck had hit her. Like, no, I don't care what you think of me. I'm speaking at an AA meeting. I'm not running for president, right? This is the what I was like part. And she gets up and she looks like the Elephant Man. She's got this no neck, these weird breasts I'd never seen before. And like she's redheaded Irish girl, and she just looked like hell. And she's coming at me. And I'm remembering the last time I saw her and that I pushed her, and I'm just ashamed, and she's happy to see me, and I'm more and more ashamed. And as she gets closer, I think, she's beautiful. Like there's something about her that's different. She just became a mom. I wasn't putting that together, but there was something authentic about her, and it made me feel so dirty and so small. And she reached into this box and pulled out Phoebe Rose. And she goes, look at her. And I could hardly look at her because she was perfect. And I've never felt more disgusting in my whole life. I told somebody today, oh, yeah, my daughter was born the day God. Somebody go, oh, that's beautiful. I'm like, no, it was terrible. Like the worst day ever, you know, because I was in the bondage of self. And my ugly paint wouldn't stick on these beautiful women. I couldn't pull my trick on them. And I just was so afraid of this. They were like living on a planet where 1 + 1 = 2. And I didn't live there anymore. And I handed Phoebe to Anna and I lied. I lied. The first thing I said in front of my daughter was a lie. I said, everything's going to be all right. And I knew because I'm going to be dead in 30 minutes. And I can't wait to get off this place. And I want to be clear. Like I've worked with people that are depressed, have real depression. I have cowardice. That's different than depression. I'm not depressed. I don't want to do the life I made. And I got in my car and I was very calm because I knew it's going to be over. I don't have to do this. They'll be better off. I actually prayed running down their stairs, please make it so these women never see me again. And I run up to my stairs and my brother is standing right in front of the door. We're swimming in it. It's everywhere. In fact, if you're here, Javi, you don't know it. You're here because of grace. You know, Cody's here because of grace. The Franks. You know, it's happening all around us. You think about it. Think all the time. It's kind of like a basketball that's not going to go in and somebody tips it. How many people tipped you today just to get you here? How many people didn't want to come here? I know who didn't want to come here. Heather. She's like, what? Speaking? No. I know. She got all dressed up and went, please don't call on me. And if this is a regular AA meeting, it's like 20% of you like, well, I didn't want to come here. I had to drive Carl, or I forgot I had a commitment. But something gets us here. And my brother was standing there, and he was just about to leave. And he had a duffel bag with my stuff, which, by the way, was fairly small. My stuff didn't fill up a whole duffel bag. And he walked out and goes, get in the car. And I go, no, my sponsor says get in the car is the most spiritual thing people say to us. And I go, no, I got to go inside. And what was I going to do? Go inside and shoot myself with my brother standing outside? Yes, because I don't want to do this. And he goes, you don't have to go inside. You don't have to go inside. And he put me in the car. I'm here today because of that guy. And he drank after 20 years. And he's been drinking for 20 years. But I'm alive because of him. I went to rehab. All I remember from rehab is I gained 47 pounds. I'm sure we did fun stuff. I was really damaged, you know. I slept for like 4 days. And then they took me to meetings and stuff, and we ate food. I remember that. And then on the way home, my brother was at a Treasures party out in Palm Springs, and he picked me up. And he dropped me off in front of my house, and he said, go to a meeting. And I used to lie, like, reflexively. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to a meeting. I'm not going to a meeting, man. I just got out of a hospital. I got 30 days. I'm bulletproof. You know, I got a baby I want to see. I got a mom I want to see. I got to do my laundry. I got to get a job. I'm not going to a meeting. But I lied all the time. I said, yeah, I wanted him to drive away. And he drove off, and I'm like, cool, man, I'll take a shower, go to the beach for a few hours, chill out, get my life in order. And I walked up, and my apartment door was unlocked. It was a little ajar, and there was music coming out of it. And I lived there by myself, so that was a little off-putting. And I hadn't been there in a month, and I pushed the door open, and there were all these people having a party, and I didn't know any of them. And it was my house, and all my guitars are gone. There's music I don't like, and there's girls in bikinis, I remember this, snorting cocaine off my glass table. It was intriguing, but I didn't know any of them. And this guy walks up and hands me a beer. You know how weird it is to get invited to a party at your house by people that don't know you live there? He's like, hey man, here. And I'm like, and I had one of those things, one of those electrical impulses. I looked around the room, and my first thought was, wow, you really have nothing. Your guitars are gone. You don't have a place to live. And then I had that saving thought. I thought, well, I got 30 days. So if you're one of the chip people, I really, really hope that those days are your most valuable possession. Because honestly, at the end of the day, all I could write my name under and say, this is mine, nothing I owned, because I owed everybody money, was I got 30 days without a drink, and I've not done that in years. Without a drug, without a drink. I was sleeping at night, getting up in the morning. I liked having 30 days. And I looked around, and the reason I got thrown out of the band is I always ran off with the fun people. And these were them. And I thought, am I going to throw away the one thing I got on these losers again? And those girls were pretty, but they weren't pretty enough for that. And I turned around and I ran away from my own apartment. And I think that's grace, because I'm the guy that tells himself he's not gonna drink and drinks anyway. And I ran, I didn't know where I was going, you know, I just ran, like, you know. And I got to a payphone and I thought, I'll call AA. And I called AA, and this guy was so great, I kind of threw up all my problems on him. And he goes, hey man, where are you? And I go, well, I'm right at the corner of Burl and Redondo Beach Boulevard. And he said, that's really weird. And I said, why is that weird? And he said, because right across the street from where you're standing, there's a meeting called Stompers, and it starts in 15 minutes. You guys thinking about your grace? all the things that happened to you. This happened to me. Call it what you want to call it. It saved my life. And I said to the guy, so what do you think I should do? Because I'm like, I thought I explained. I have real unique problems. You know? I thought he'd send a therapist and a car and some cold water, you know. And I remember his voice. He goes, I think we should go to that meeting. Like, he's like, dude, it's right across the street. But I was afraid. And I didn't know I was afraid. And I went in that meeting. It scared the hell out of me. It was a big meeting. It was like 500 people in this meeting. And there was a chair. You know when you're new and there's one chair and there's a big spotlight on it? And I'm like going to the chair, like hoping people can't see me. And I sit there and I remember the guy got up and he said, "Womp, womp, 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 womp." And I'm like, oh no. And he kept, I couldn't understand. Like, what? And he kept saying these weird gibberish. And he goes, these are tools for living. So I look up there and I'm like, oh, they're in Chinese. I felt like I was on like the Twilight Zone, but I was safe. So I got up, and in Buddhism, there's a precept called the 10,000 things. And with it's like grace. In Buddhism, they say 10,000 things happened so the next moment can happen. And this happened that night. I was leaving that meeting and I didn't know where I was going to go. And one of my brother's friends, who'd never been to that meeting, I later found out, walked by and goes, hey, you're little Neil, you're Neil's brother. And he goes, yeah, and this is AA. He goes, I heard you look like crap. I go, well, that was 30 days ago. You know, I've been working on myself. Like, what do you want me to say? And he goes, hey, can I give you a ride home? And I was like laughing, thinking that'd be great. I ran here, you know. And he goes, okay. But we went out to his car, and I wouldn't get in his car because what am I going to tell him? Where are we going? And he leaned over and rolled down his window. He goes, what is your problem? And I told him about my apartment. And he goes, well, don't your parents live near here? And I go, oh, no, man. They lived 2 miles away from this meeting, right over the hill. They lived right on the border of Torrance and Redondo, and I'm in Redondo. But this is important if you're new. I had a perception of what that would be like. And my perception, I was sure, was supported by reality. And my perception was, they've been married for 45 years. They're madly in love with each other. This loser, fresh out of rehab with his baby across town, is not showing up. They've suffered enough. I'm not showing up. It's going to be terrible for them. And then, of course, it's going to be humiliating for me. I played at CBGB's last year, man. I'm not moving into my parents' house, you know. And he got me in the car. And he was one of five guys in my brother's group that had painted my parents' house. 10,000 things. And he took me to my parents' house against my will. I remember I walked up to the porch and I knocked on the door. And it was really weird, all these little moments that I remember. But there was a guitar pick with my signature on it on the porch. And I hadn't been there for 7 months. And I knew that because they told me that when they took me to rehab. And I'm like, my parents are fastidious. They're really clean. My dad was in the war. My mom was just kept a really nice house. This was weird. So it kept me on the porch. And I don't know if anybody's been to Torrance. It's just parents' house. There's like nowhere to go. It's all parents' house for miles. So I didn't have anywhere to go. And I'm looking down at this guitar pick, and they opened the door. And they were glad to see me. Like, like really glad. Like my mom gasped. My mom was this frail little woman who was getting eaten away by cancer, and this joy came out of her. I couldn't believe it. Remember my perception? Well, I apparently looked through a kaleidoscope of resentment and guilt and fear, and darkness, and you know, I know what's coming. And right, if I just moved it to the left, right in front of me was perfect reality. It's always perfect. Reality is always perfect. I have a friend, I go, how are you doing? He goes, well, reality is really rubbing me the wrong way today. It does do that. But there's nothing wrong with reality. And it was perfect. I didn't know. You know what was happening at my parents' house for 30 days? My dad, for 30 nights, he told me this weeks later, was helping my mom kneel down by the side of the bed. And they were praying rosaries for me. Because they didn't know if I was going to make it. They saw the skeleton. It was perfect. You know what I learned in AA is uncomfortable, really uncomfortable, is perfect. A lot of the time. I'm from the school of, no, I want to be a Corona beer commercial. I want Mexico and beautiful women and alive. But uncomfortable is perfect. And I live with my mom and dad for my first year. I got my 60-day chip, my 90-day chip, holding my mom at night, putting her to bed with my dad, holding my dad when he's crying at night. It was really uncomfortable. Really uncomfortable. And I would kill to do that again. I would do anything to have that year again. I learned more about love and intimacy and faith from those two people. And they were right in front of me. And you know, the second step says we came to believe, right? It says we came. And I want to be, if you're new here, it doesn't say your sponsor read "We Agnostics" at you until you went, "Uncle, we come naturally to believe," right? Because there is sort of this, well, do you believe yet? I was like, Jesus, chill out. It says came to believe. And I don't know when it happened, but I remember the day, I remember what happened. I don't know if I was 60 days or 90 days. But I remember I woke up in my old bedroom at my parents' house. The only comforting thing in that room was this poster of Eric Clapton that I put up there when I was 13. And he was there, and I used to talk to him every day. He, and, you know, he was silent and wise. But I wake up, and I smelled my dad making breakfast, and that doesn't work in our house. My mom makes breakfast. My dad went from high school to World War II to college to married. He's never made breakfast in his life. And I'm like, uh-oh. Like, I had the little spidey sense, that's not good. So it was early. I hadn't gone to 7. I was going to 3 meetings a day to get out of my parents' house. They were uncomfortable. You know why they were uncomfortable? They were honest and kind and friendly. I just hadn't been around that kind of nonsense in a really long time. It made me feel creepy. It really did. I asked my dad, why was there a guitar pick on the porch? I asked him like 2 months in. He goes, you know, the last time you left, you pulled your keys out and I watched it fall. And I almost said something, but you were really sick. And I thought, I'm going to leave that there till he comes back because I'm going to miss him. Grace. I didn't know. So I go, okay, I got some time. I was going to 3 meetings a day to leave the uncomfortable place. But just like Heather said, I'd come to you guys, and this was way worse than my parents' house. I'd be like, what's going on here? All this hugging and bad coffee and really weird stuff we're laughing at. I mean, my first 3 months, I'm like, you guys are crazy. But I had nowhere else to go. And I got up in the morning, I ran down to help my dad make breakfast, and he's making a mess of it. I'm helping him get stuff in the right pan. The bacon was in the wrong pan. Eggs are on the counter. And while I'm doing this, he starts telling me how much he loves my mother, which I know. But he's telling me about a long marriage and intimacy in a long marriage. And I was doing this, hearing him, not looking at him, and I thought, this man is so beautiful. And I turned and looked at him and thought, he's been here the whole time. But I got enough relief from the bondage of self to see perfect reality. Perfect reality. Then I looked at my watch. It's like 6:45. I got to get to the 7 a.m. meeting. Only because Carol goes to the 7 a.m. meeting. And she speaks inappropriately about her sex life. And I like that. I really look forward to Carol's shares, you know. I don't want to date Carol. I just want to ruminate on Carol, you know. So I go, Dad, I got to go. And some of you are like, oh, I think I'm Carol. And other ones are like, I know Carol, you know. Carol got well eventually. So I think she was just afraid too. But I raced down to the meeting, and I get in there, and Bill's there. The guy who later became my sponsor. And I thought, God, I love that guy. He's so funny. He's so comforting. And it just started to happen. I came to believe. I got the sponsor, and we'd read the book together in his house. He'd read it at home, then we'd read it again, and we walked through the steps, and when we got to the step, we worked it. That's why I'm so glad Heather brought up the third step, because we got to the third step, and I don't know this guy that well, you know, and it's like I'm 90 days sober maybe. And I remember I used to come into this courtyard, and he'd wait in his doorway, buzz me in, and I remember being so self-conscious just walking across the courtyard and thinking people are looking at me, you know. And then we'd go in there, and I remember he always would lock his door. I thought, that's weird, because, you know, the courtyard's locked. He'd lock his door, and then it's just me and him, this guy I don't know that well. And we're just getting to the third step. And he goes, okay, we read the whole thing. You know, you'll have a new employer, which was awesome. I didn't have an employer. And He said, so we're going to get on our knees now on my floor and we're going to hold hands. I'm like, oh, no, we're not. Like, that's weird. That's really weird. I don't, like, Jeffrey Dahmer showed up. You know? I really did. I was like, this is really uncomfortable. And he goes, we're going to get down. I'm going to say this prayer. You're going to repeat after me. And I'm like, I couldn't believe it. This was out of, you know, we've done one too. Nothing weird happened. Then he gets on his knees and he looks so lonely down there. You know, I'm not mean. And he's down there and I'm standing there. So I got on my knees and we held hands. And, you know, if you've ever held hands face to face kneeling, you're making out. Like, you're like real close. And he's going, I offer myself to thee. I'm like, I offer myself to thee. It was so weird. And I remember he said that, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I remember that got through. And I went, oh, God, I would love that. And then we got done with that prayer. And I want to say, I didn't get up and go, I've given my life to God. You know, I got up and went, that was freaking weird. Right? And I go, well, what do I mean? What does that mean? And he goes, well, do the rest of the steps. Prove it. And I go, okay, I just got to get out of here. I want to go home. And by then, I'm driving my dad's car. And I go home. And driving home, I remember thinking this. That's why I like that Heather brought this up. Is I remember thinking, I just did something that was really uncomfortable. That I don't understand. Because I don't want to live like an animal anymore. And that's this whole thing. That's the whole program. I still do that. Why am I driving to Santa Maria? I love being next to my wife every day. I love my dogs. I love my guitars. I'm just going to go do that thing that's a little bit uncomfortable. You did the uncomfortable thing the other day. And that changed me over time. But what's the third step really look like if you're new? Like, what does it mean? Well, I went to my sponsor and my brother said, hey, I got you an interview. This is like 3 months later. At this place, and I was making no money working at this like newspaper at night, stacking newspapers. And he said, it's a warehouse manager job. I think it's a salary job. And it's a funny thing I learned, when you don't think you're going to get the job, you interview really well. Because I had no pressure. I was like, I'm not going to get this job. My resume says, went to a party for 11 years. You know? And so I go in there, and he's asking me questions. And I'm thinking about the questions and candidly answering them, thinking I got no chance. And he kept being very impressed. And he goes, I think you're the guy. And I go, really? And he goes, I'm not going to interview anybody else. And I couldn't believe it. He goes, and I go, well, what's the salary? And he told me, and it was only like 400% more than I was making. Right? And I'm paying child support, you know, and I'm living with my parents, and I don't have a car that works. And I had a car, it just didn't work. And I couldn't believe it. And I thought, God's will. And I went to my brother's work. He worked really not very far because he had this air freight company. And I said, hey, man, I got that job. And he goes, I thought you'd get that job. And I go, yeah. And he goes, when do you start? And I go, Monday at 6 p.m. 6 p.m.? But your home group's the Monday Night Men's Stack. I go, yeah, but there's more meetings. And he goes, is it every night at 6 p.m.? I go, yeah, 6 to 2. I'm the night manager. And he goes, you have the Tuesday night step study, the Wednesday night surf and sand. You can't go to that meeting. You can't take that job. And I remember thinking, he's crazy. This is like my way out. So I ignored him. And I went and took a shower. I drove to my meeting. I went to my sponsor and said, hey, I got that job. He goes, oh, that's great. He goes, when do you start? I go, Monday at 6 p.m. And he goes, you can't take that job. And I didn't. And that's step three. Self-will. Or people who only love me and have no agenda at all. And you know how hard it was to go to that stupid newspaper loading dock when I knew I could be making 400% more. But I was starting to realize my perception was not reality. And I just started doing stuff like that. And so what happened? Surrender grace. Surrender grace. So about 6 months later, I'm like a year and 3 months sober. We have our big Monday Night Men's Stag. It's like 100 guys, no seats, lining the walls. I had a seat because I'd get there early. You go in there, and we always ask, is there anybody from out of town like you guys did? Hello, Oceanside, you know. And I go in there, and this guy, they go, is anybody from out of town? And this guy was wearing a suit, which we don't do at my meeting. We're beach guys. And he goes, my name's Kevin. I'm visiting from Australia. And he goes, I'm going to come once a month. And I thought, I'll remember that guy's name. That will be my great act of altruism. And I'll be relieved of the bondage of self. Because my sponsor just said, don't say the prayer, do something good for somebody. And I was like, that's dumb. But I saw this guy. I really was. I mean, I'm shallow. My sponsor says? My shallowness knows no depth. But I'm looking at this guy thinking, wow, he's traveling. He's coming here from Australia. So I kind of forgot about the guy, but a month later, there's Kevin, and I run to Kevin, and I go, Kevin, welcome back to the greatest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And he goes, wow, you remembered my name. What do you do for a living? And I said, I'm so embarrassed, you know. I had 2 degrees, I traveled the world, and now I'm working minimum wage. And he goes, wow, I didn't really understand that. And he gave me his card and goes, come to my office, I think I have a job for you. And he's vice president of an international airline. Surrender grace. I didn't find out he was vice president and go hustle him for a job. I tried to make him feel comfortable at a meeting. That's a big difference. God was like, hey, the boy's getting it, right? So what happened there? I got this job, and I remember they gave me an allowance to clean my suit, and I'm thinking, is that because I'm scummy? Like, I really took it personally. And then I found out everybody got the allowance to clean their suit. I thought it was like, not that guy. He's not going to even take a shower. But I did. I was getting good, you know. My life was good. Living with mom and dad, going to meetings all the time. Got this job at the airline. And I remember one day I asked my sponsor. I was paying all the money back. And I said, can I buy a guitar? I really need a guitar. I'm like jonesing. And he goes, yeah, of course. So I went to the Guitar Center and I bought a Taylor Dan Curry single cutaway. It's like beautiful. If you play guitar, you're jealous of me now. And I'm okay because I work the steps. I have self-esteem. So I get to work and nobody trusts me because I've been hired by the vice president and I don't drink or chase women. Like, who's going to chase women? Like, hey, baby, I'm an AA. I live with my mom and my dad and I have a baby. Want to have dinner? Like, I'm not going out, you know. I'd actually prayed to the statue of Mary at my church, like, help me not date women, right? And because I'd blow it. So nobody wants to see this guitar. So I kept visiting it in my locker and petting it, you know, and couldn't wait to get home and ravish it, you know. And they're sexy. Taylors are sexy. Their cases are sexy. And I go out to the employee bus stop, and I'm standing there. I might go 1 minute over. I'm standing at the employee bus stop, and I'm so lonely now. Got a year and 3 months. My mom and dad don't want to see this guitar. Nobody cares. And I just had that newcomer, like, I just kind of went down. So I turned to this woman who just walked up to the bus stop from British Airways. And I turned and go, hey, can I show you this new guitar? I just bought it on the way to work. She looks at me and she goes, I don't look at strange men's guitars. And I was like, God, lady, you know, I'm not hitting on you. Believe me, I'm no chick magnet, you know. I just really wanted, I didn't care if it was Herman Munster. I just wanted someone to look at my, but she turned out, when she turned towards me, to be quite beautiful. And she probably got hit on a lot, and I felt stupid. So now I feel worse. So we get on the bus, and she's pressed against me, which is her bad luck, because it's crowded. It's the international terminal at 10:30 at night. And I looked down, and she had a book in her hand called Surprised by Joy that I read in college by C.S. Lewis. And she's really uncomfortable. She wants me to vanish. And I go, hey, I've read that book. And she goes, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God? And I go, God saved my life. Like, click, you know. And I just watched her go, holy crap. Like, this is getting worse. It was so bad. I'm like, oh, come back, words, you know. And now I'm just like, please, please let this bus ride end. But she just said, well, I don't believe in God. And I said, well, tell me about that. I used to not believe in God. And she started telling me about, and I talked about Hinduism and God as the timeless plenitude of being. And she wasn't impressed with that. And when we got to the end of the bus, all I remember is I said, well, I don't know anybody that would believe in the God that you don't believe in. I believe in the God that grows my hair and beats my heart. And we got off the bus and I was walking back to my car, but I felt something unique standing next to that person. And I just knew to go back. And I went back and said, would you like to have dinner? And she said, oh, right. Look at my guitar. I've read that book. And it kind of lit me up. Like, she got really, really surgically mean, like really quickly. And I was shocked because I thought we had a nice chat. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. No is a complete answer. Because I'm doing steps, man. I like me. And I've never liked me. But I got a year and 3 months, and I don't mind being in my skin now. And I said, no is a complete answer. And that took her off guard, and she goes, okay, no. And I said, okay. And I said, I think we're missing something. And I went home to my dad, who waited up at night for me, and I walked in the door, and I said, Dad, I met this girl, and she felt like home. And I totally blew it. And I told him about it, and on the way down the hall, he said, that story's not over. And I go, Dad, you did not hear her. It is over. Like, but I thought about her all night. I talked to Eric Clapton about her. I got ready for work, going, Eric, I don't know, man. And went to work, and I saw her, and I'm trying not to think about her, and I can't stop thinking about her, but I don't want to embarrass her, so I try to catch the early bus. And she comes up behind me, and she goes, hey, I think I was rude to you. She has a great British accent. And I go, that's okay. She goes, I'm not going to go out with you. And I go, you've been so clear. You know, we don't really need to rehash this. And she said, but I'll have coffee with you if you want to miss this. And I'm really sensitive to caffeine. And it's 10:30 at night. I'm like, yeah, let's have coffee. And 17 days after that day, she proposed to me. And we've been married for 30 years. Bam, bam. That happens here. Surrender, grace, love. Surrender, grace, love. Like love like I've never thought was possible for a loser like me. I remember she said, we should buy a house. I go, they don't sell guys like me houses. And they did. Then she said, we should have a baby. I'm like, really, with me? And you know who came to the hospital when we had that baby? Anne and Phoebe. I know. We went when they had babies. They came when we had babies. We had another one. We adopted one. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe we adopted one. I didn't want to do that. But my wife said, well, you sure talk about principles a lot. So I adopted a baby. I adopted a 12-year-old. But what I want to say this, you know, sometimes people come up here and they go, I was a terrible person, and then I got sober, and now butterflies come out of my butt. And that's not true. That never happens. It never happens, ever. You know, I've had a real life. My wife, when we were 7 years married, had a massive stroke. And I've been her caregiver for 23 years. And she is perfect reality. There is nothing wrong with our life. We adopted a baby after she got paralyzed. She is the love of my life, just like my dad had. So, you know, we come here and people come up to you and they lie to you. They go, hey, are you new? Yeah, everything is going to be all right. Really? No, it's not. It's not. We shouldn't say that to people. What we should say is what we mean. If you come here and you work these elegant spiritual exercises every day for the rest of your life, no matter what happens, you're going to be all right. That's my experience. Thanks.
Let's keep it going for Matt.